listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2012 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Sometimes a great biographer comes along and enhances, even changes, our common view of a world leader. This was the case here a few weeks ago when Los Angeles Times editor Jim Newton spoke about Dwight Eisenhower, which he gave us great new insights. Mahatma Gandhi has been the subject of at least 30 full-length biographies in English alone. To American readers who may only know the basic outlines of his life, Joseph Lilienfeld's biography, Great Soul, Mahatma Gandhi and His Struggle with India, will come as a revelation. Mr. Lilienfeld has, in the words of one reviewer, restored human depth to the Mahatma, the plaster saint, allowing his flawed human readers to feel a little closer to his lofty ideals of nonviolence and universal brotherhood. As well as a disciplined religious ascetic, in Lilienfeld's biography, we meet Gandhi as a troubled, changeable, wily, and occasionally egotistical politician. British historian Judith Brown claims in her introduction to the Cambridge Companion to Gandhi that, quote, anyone who considers many of the fundamental issues of human life, its goals, its capacities, and the nature of men and women in public communities, issues of violence and cooperation, will find that Gandhi has been there before and struggled with them. Gandhi was, to quote Joseph Lilienfeld, a man of many causes, and there were many who were hostile to him, Hindu nationalists, left-wing Indians, fearful Muslims. Winston Churchill wanted Gandhi to be, quote, bound hand and foot at the gates of Delhi and then trampled on by an enormous elephant with a new viceroy seated on his back. I loved that description. Gandhi pitted himself against a wide array of political and social trends, but the real tragedy of his life, Joseph Lilienfeld argues, was, quote, not because he was assassinated, nor because his noblest qualities inflamed the hatred in his killer's heart. The tragic element is that he was ultimately forced, like Lear, to see the limits of his ambition to remake the world. Joseph Lilienfeld's interest in Gandhi dates back to tours in India and South Africa as a correspondent for the New York Times, where he worked for nearly four decades and later became its executive editor. He won the Pulitzer Prize in 1986 for his book Move Your Shadow, an incisive account of South African apartheid. Omaha Blues, A Memory Loop, is Lilienfeld's tender and lucid memoir about his parents, which he narrated with both wisdom and humility. Nicholas Goldberg, who will be in conversation with Joseph Lilienfeld tonight, is editor of the Los Angeles Times opinion coverage. He joined the LA Times in 2002 as editor of the editorial pages and the Sunday opinion section. He's a former reporter and editor at Newsday, where he worked as the Middle East bureau chief from 1995 to 1998, covering the Israeli-Palestinian peace process, presidential elections in Iran, arms monitoring in Iraq, famine in Sudan, civil war in Algeria, and the rise of Islamic fundamentalism in Saudi Arabia. And now he's working on those editorials about the NFL stadium here in LA. Please welcome, join me in welcoming Joseph Lilienfeld and Nicholas Goldberg to the LA Public Library. Thank you.
Thank you.
I can't remember. I think that's yours.
That's me.
Can't remember.
No, they switched us.
We were given strict orders about where to sit and promptly forgot. Good evening. Thanks for coming. I'm Nick. I think you're going to be pleased to hear this discussion with Joe Lilienfeld. I devoured his book in just a couple of days. I didn't know that much about Gandhi. I think like many people, I had an image of a sort of little ascetic, frail man in, you know, in a strange foreign costume who looked something like Ben Kingsley, who single-handedly brought down the British Empire. I was surprised to learn an awful lot of things in the book. I mean, Gandhi, it turns out, was, according to Joe's book, was far more quirky, more pragmatic, more manipulative, more human, more disliked than I had known before. And another thing that comes across, and I think you heard it in the opening statement, is that he was much more of a failure. There were many things that he wanted to accomplish that he simply failed to accomplish. At the same time, he was fearless, he was persistent, he was utterly inspirational, and that comes through in the book too. So there's a lot of duality and complication and contradiction that comes out in the book that I hope Joe will talk about. I wanted to start by asking you what it's like to write a book about someone who's been, you know, beatified and hagiographized. You say in the book, you talk about something you call heritage myth-making, and then in another place you talk about the mistily viewed national epic. So I wonder, what does that mean? What kind of myth-making has there been about Gandhi? What is that myth? And did you get a lot of reaction when you tried to write a warts and all portrait?
Well, I didn't set out to write a warts and all portrait or to prove that Gandhi was human. It never occurred to me that he wasn't human. And I was somewhat surprised. Most of the reviews of the book and a lot of the reaction has come down to that point, that I've looked at him clearly beyond the hagiography. Well, that's nice to hear, but it was a little surprising to me, too, because it wasn't. I wouldn't have listed that as one of my motives. My main motive was to explore a side of Gandhi that I became aware of as a correspondent, both in South Africa and India. Which had to do with how he became Gandhi in his 21 years in South Africa and the values he took on there, which were not, on the whole, values that you could say were central to Indian culture, such as, and I'm speaking specifically of social justice, social equality. Gandhi wrestled with issues of caste and untouchability in the course of becoming an Indian nationalist in South Africa. His first insight was that we all have to get together as Indians here because we're a small minority in this country. We can't just be Bengalis and Punjabis and Brahmins and Banyas. We have to be Indians. The South African whites tended to call all Indians coolies, and Gandhi responded, "Indian is the proper name." That in itself was a breakthrough, and then he wrote a pamphlet about the rights of Indians as equal citizens in the British Empire to equality in South Africa. This is an editorial writer in Johannesburg, presumably an Englishman, wrote, "What's this about granting Indians equality? They don't grant it to one another." And that really hit Gandhi very hard, and became Gandhi's whole life in South Africa is a series of epiphanies. He had more epiphanies than any public man you can think of. He had them almost every 2 years, but that was one of the big ones. And that's the beginning of the process that leads to the development of Gandhi as a mass movement leader by the time he's left South Africa, with his whole philosophy of satyagraha, which translates loosely as firmness in truth, worked out, with his position of nonviolence worked out, with his pledge of celibacy and the search for selflessness and social service worked out. He's Gandhi by the time he leaves South Africa at the age of 44. And that's what I was trying to explain. And in the course of it, I was guided largely by his words and came upon, as you would with any figure that's expressed himself in the volume that Gandhi that his collected works run to about 100 volumes, came upon a lot of contradictions in his accounts of how things happened. And I try to work them out where they're important to my analysis. And in doing that, I guess I showed that he wasn't always consistent.
Well, let me stop you there. You talk about him shading history. You talk about him editing out unfortunate details. You talk about his retrospective tidying up of certain details. You talk about exaggerations. You talk about things that he states where the evidence simply isn't there. So this is more than just small contradictions. He was trying to create an image of himself, wasn't he?
Barack Obama wrote a book about how he became Barack Obama. There are issues in that book that one could point to. George Romney has spent the last few months trying to get a consistent story of who he is. I think this is somehow built into leaders who, you know, the problem that face leaders who explore their past.
And yet in Gandhi's case, it goes against, again, this myth and image we have of him as such a man of extraordinary principle, unbending, a man of, my sense was, you know, I would expect, you know, unending honesty, because he was a man who was willing to die for what he believed in.
That is largely true. The fact that he was sometimes inconsistent, or that he shaded the story to make a point. His autobiography appeared originally in articles and in chapters in his. In his weekly newspaper that he published. He always had a weekly newspaper. He was a great polemicist and in a way, journalist. It appeared every week over the course of a year, and then it was published as an autobiography, actually two volumes. And Gandhi didn't do huge research in archives or have a staff of assistants the way George W. Bush might have to make consistent his position. Each of these things is a kind of parable about what you must do if you're going to behave courageously and fearlessly in a struggle for truth and justice. And so he would tell the story of something that happened to him in South Africa, typically, to make a point to his Indian movement and followers. I don't think it's surprising that when you hold those anecdotes, it's a great book, but when you actually look at what happened, that it's not absolutely consistent and correct.
So when Gandhi arrives in South Africa, my impression from the way you've written about it and from some of the photographs in the book is that he arrives as a would-be Brit. I mean, he's a barrister, he's just been educated in the law in London. And how does this transformation take place?
Well, he's a would-be Brit. Of course, I start the book in South Africa. If this were a full biography, I would have started it. I would have dealt with his childhood and his period in England. I don't deal with that a lot. But he's a very peculiar kind of Brit, because he's a Brit who's interested in mystical philosophy. He's a Brit who has allied himself with the various vegetarian movements in Britain. And Theosophy, which was a kind of Western-Eastern cult that was very popular in that era. And he falls in with a bunch of evangelical Christians in Pretoria who see him as a very ripe subject for conversion. He later said that he hadn't seriously thought about converting. But in fact, he went to church and he went to daily prayer sessions, and he came under their influence to a certain extent. How he then emerges as a leader? Well, at first he's hired as a lawyer by a group of well-to-do Muslims, traders. And they need, in effect, a mouthpiece, and that's the role he finally fills. He's going through this kind of spiritual evolution while he's laying down a career as an attorney in Durban, in the beginning. And so he's both speaking for the community and trying to find his own framework of values. He's very young at this point. He was 23 when he arrived. And so it's not surprising that that he's searching in the way he is. When he writes about it later, he writes about it as if he is already on the road to Mahatmahood. But I don't think it worked that way.
And there are certain of the issues that ultimately become his signature issues that he really evolves on during those South Africa
Absolutely.
Years. And as he becomes involved with indentured laborers, that's where I think he first opens his eyes to this issue of caste. Mm-hmm. So can you talk a little bit about...
Yeah, well, let's talk about that. There were in this period about 100,000 Indians in South Africa. Most of them came over as indentured laborers. That means they came over on 5-year contracts, bonding them, in effect, to plantation owners, the sugar plantations, and coal mines, where they worked as miners, and to a lesser degree as domestic servants and waiters and things like that. But it's still a very small community. There were 10 times as many Zulus in the provinces of Natal, where most Indians were, as there were Indians. And the Indians were more, there were not quite as many Indians as there were whites. So they were the smallest group. And I've just lost your question as I... Which was
about the indentured labor.
Yeah. Oh, and the indenture was just a sort of step up from slavery, except that it had a time limit. An indentured laborer who left the his place of work, basically under the laws that existed in South Africa at the time, had committed a crime, for which he could be arrested or could even be flogged. And Gandhi saw that right away, but his real effort in the beginning was to speak for the property owning or aspiring middle class Indians, a very small number of that 100,000. I can't guess what it was, but you know, less than 10,000 probably, or just 10,000. So he was trying to draw a distinction between the coolies, the indentured laborers, who were low caste and of uncouth habit and probably illiterate and not English speaking, and the people he represented and was organizing for, and who were campaigning for some form of political equality and social equality. And basically, the whites of South Africa, as we all know, weren't buying social equality with people of a darker hue. Not so much because they had prejudices against Indians, although they soon did, but because how could you then justify the way they treated Africans? Africans were obviously the big question. So
not one that Gandhi cared much about.
Not at that point, yeah. And so Gandhi sees the problem of the indentured laborers, and he writes about it with some insight, but he doesn't do much about it for many years because he's trying to represent the people, the former indentured laborers who somehow stayed on in South Africa and achieved a kind of citizenship there, and the traders who he originally represented. But as the years go on, he's driven to, both by his consideration of caste and by the evolution of Indian aspirations to come to terms with the problems of the indentured laborers. And this happens only in the last year and a half of his 21 years in South Africa. And then he leads a series of remarkable strikes on the coal mines and sugar plantations of South Africa that for a brief time get the attention of a lot of the world, not in our sense with CNN or something like that, but is covered in the British press, engages the British government, engages the Indian viceroy and the South African authorities, and it's a movement he propels, and basically shuts down the sugar plantations and the mines for the better part of 2 months, during which he's finally jailed. And at the end, they patch up a kind of compromise. But I believe that if Gandhi hadn't had that experience with the indentured laborers, and I try to rather minutely explain in the book how that evolved, if he had gone home in 1912 rather than 1914, he wouldn't have become the Gandhi he became in India. He went home with an experience that no other Indian leader had had up to that point. The Indian national movement existed, but it was an elite movement of English-speaking lawyers and people who aspired to a kind of parliamentary system in India, but it didn't represent the masses of India in any significant way, and for the most part didn't aspire to represent them. And Gandhi came home with an aspiration to turn it into a mass movement, and did that remarkably in a period of 5 or 6 years. I mean, he comes home where he's known to a handful of thousands of people in the country, basically people who read English language newspapers, and this is before mass communications as we know it, by 1921, 22, anywhere he goes in the country, he's become the unquestioned leader of the national movement, and anywhere he goes in the country, 50,000, 100,000 people turn up to hear him speak. How that happened is one of the great questions of Indian history.
So I think most people identify Gandhi primarily with the independence movement, possibly with nonviolence. But these two other issues that you've talked about that began to germinate in South Africa were really, at least as far as I can tell from the book, really what preoccupied him even more. One was caste divisions, dealing with lower caste Indians, and the other was Hindu-Muslim relations. I wondered if you
also
could just
mass rural poverty.
Yeah, I was going to get to that.
Yeah.
But I wonder if you'd talk briefly about caste divisions and talk. I mean, I was familiar with untouchables. I'd never heard of unseeability or
Gandhi had unapproachability.
Unapproachability.
It was actually true in areas of South India at the turn of the last century that some of the higher castes felt they should never have to see an untouchable. Not just be touched by an untouchable, but see them. And so untouchables were expected to stay out of their view, and if they needed to stay off public roads, and if they needed to be on public roads, to make honking sounds or beat with a stick or something to show that they were in the area so that the untouchables could avert their gaze. And that was called unapproachability. And they actually worked it out in parts of what's now Kerala to the number of steps. One of the lowest untouchable groupings, the Palayas, could only come within 64 steps of a Nair, and then a slightly higher kind of untouchable could come within 44 steps of a Nair. Gandhi himself was amazed by this. He had never heard of it when he first got down there. And one of the things that happened as ideas of breaking down the system sort of infiltrated from various sources, Western examples, Christian missionaries, social ferment among caste Hindus as well. The system stiffened in a way, just as in our country, Jim Crow became more difficult and firmer after the Civil War and after Reconstruction. And just as in South Africa, apartheid, as it came to be called, the segregation was widely practiced, but it wasn't legislated in the detail, in the immense and fanatic detail in which it was later legislated in 1948, and we had a half century of the most rigorous kind of white supremacy. In South Africa, the caste system became more rigid as it began to be questioned, and that's part of what Gandhi ran into.
Let's talk just a little bit about excrement. A part of being untouchable had to do with cleaning shit, if I'm correct. And Gandhi had all sorts of
things.
That's
still a problem in India, where a majority of the population does not use anything that could be called plumbing or modern or even decent outhouses or latrines.
But one of Gandhi's solutions for this was to have people of higher castes do some of that cleaning. Can you explain a little what he expected of people who were his followers, his wife, his...
Gandhi believed, and this was a concept that he was very good at grabbing ideas and pulling them into an Indian context from other places. And he read early on, while he was still in South Africa, in fact, at the beginning of his stay in South Africa, Tolstoy's first great outpouring as a social prophet toward the end of his life, a radical Christian tract called The Kingdom of God is Within You. And there are references in there to the servants who come and empty our chamber pots and how we treat them. And Tolstoy rails against that. Gandhi immediately applies it to the Indian context and says, adopts the Tolstoyan value that we all must be responsible for the removal of our own wastes and self-reliant in that sense.
And other people's.
So Gandhi felt that his workers, his followers, and on this level, he had tens of millions of followers as the leader of the independence movement. When it came to cleaning up shit, he had dozens, maybe hundreds of followers.
Shock.
And he promulgated the idea that his workers should go into villages and teach people the value of being responsible for themselves and granting equality to the poorest among them. And the great symbol of that would be that they would clean up the villages. He never got over the problem, though. He never found a solution for the problem. Once a Gandhian worker or Gandhi himself attempted to do this and went into a village and was seen to be cleaning up excrement from the pathways of the village, they were, in the eyes of the caste Hindus in the villagers, turning themselves into untouchables. Therefore, their ability to preach to them was diminished, not right. raised. And he never quite found the solution for that one.
So just as he spent decades on untouchability, he also spent decades trying to bring Hindus and Muslims together. But in a similar way, he, despite this incredible reverence that you talk about, despite the fact that 50,000 people were turning out to watch his train pass, he really never convinced people to go along with him. And in the end, as we know, despite his efforts, India was partitioned, and Pakistan was created as a Muslim state.
With some of the worst mass killing we've seen in modern times. So at the end of the whole Gandhian endeavor, there's the fracture of the society he was trying to heal and bring together, and this outpouring of unbelievable violence, which contradicted everything he believed in. It happened to Gandhi a couple of times in his life, where he'd go somewhere and he would hear about situations in which Hindus, supposed followers of Gandhi and his movement, were slaughtering Muslims in retaliation for something they thought Muslims had done to Hindus, and in the process shouting, "Mahatma Gandhi Ki Jai," which means glory to Mahatma Gandhi, as they basically ignored and swept aside every value he had sought to inculcate.
Do you think that the partition of India was inevitable?
You know, if you can tell, you're expert on the Middle East, if you can tell me how Israel-Palestine is going to work out in the end, then I'll tell you if I thought it was inevitable.
We're desperate for partition. Israel.
I think one can imagine other solutions, but both communities were being borne away by their own aspirations and lack of sensitivity to one another, and it didn't work. There are moments when it came close, and Gandhi was involved in a lot of those moments. But basically, I think Muhammad Ali Jinnah, the leader and founder of the Pakistan movement, might have settled for a decentralized Indian governmental structure in which Muslims had an assured minority status at the center over national security and foreign affairs issues and other national issues, and where the Muslim majority provinces had a considerable amount of home rule, and where the Hindu majority provinces granted an assured minority stake to Muslim parties, he might have. But that was so far away from what the Indian National Congress, by that time more under Nehru's leadership than Gandhi's, aspired to. They aspired to a kind of Fabian socialist state, which was going to nationalize major industries and rule from the center and promulgate standards of governance. They wanted to compromise with the Muslims, sure, but on their terms. And so it didn't work. There are moments when you think it might have worked, but I, if I really had to vote on that, I guess I would say it was inevitable. But it wasn't inevitable that it had to happen with the rush that it did at the end, and it wasn't inevitable that it became the ghastly mess that it became. And it wasn't inevitable that India and Pakistan now face each other as two nuclear powers, spending billions of dollars a year to station armies in the Himalayas so that they can fight over the Kashmir Valley as they've been fighting over it for 70 years now. A lot of that is just crazy. And if you could imagine Gandhi walking back on the scene, you can also imagine him saying so.
I mean, Gandhi was so vehemently opposed to the creation of Pakistan long after most of his disciples, including Nehru and others, were all for it. Can you talk a little bit, because I think it gives...
But he didn't break with them publicly on it.
No, he never broke with them, but he did. But Can you talk a little bit about, and I know we're jumping ahead here, but some of the things he did in the final years to try to stop it? He took one last walk at the age, you know, he was well into his 70s. Can you describe that?
Because I think this to me is, I say somewhere that Philip Glass starts his opera about Gandhi Satyagraha in South Africa. If I were writing that opera, I would have concentrated on Gandhi's last years rather than the beginning. He gets to the point where he sees that his movement isn't following him. They're all devoted to him. They all say that were it not for his fearlessness and the example he set, India never would have reached the point of being near to independence. But they're not listening to him anymore. And he, as they get into the heaviest negotiations with the British and Jinnah over how this is all going to work, Gandhi does an amazing thing. He leaves New Delhi and he goes to East Bengal, what's now Bangladesh, about 1,000 miles away. If you look at the map of India, he couldn't have gone any further and still have been in what was British India. And he goes to the place he has selected because there have been a sequence of communal killings just starting, really the prelude to what was going to come at partition. Excuse me. In this district called Noakhali district, several hundred Hindus have been killed in retail, and the reports that have come out have made it thousands of Hindus, but it was probably several hundred have been killed, and it's a Muslim majority area where most of the land is owned by Hindus, which is an incendiary situation anywhere. Anyway, Gandhi goes in there with a small band of followers, village workers, and his idea is to make a peace march from village to village in order to demonstrate that Hindus can live peacefully in these villages from which they've fled as refugees. He's trying to persuade the terrorized Hindus to come back, and he's trying to calm down the Muslims, and he's doing this by a pilgrimage of walking from village to village in an area that basically had no roads. It was mostly communication by canal and river, but he walked barefoot, and he did it. He did it for 4 months.
How old was he?
He was 77, and his idea, which might make sense in today's world of modern communications, was that if he could set an example there, if he by his presence could calm down that district and show that the two communities could in fact live together, that idea might spread faster than the terror that was spreading across the border areas of British India, and it's a mystical wispy idea, and in fact, British India, there are no television crews following him. People aren't aware from day to day that he's doing this. And the effect in the district itself is minimal because the Muslims are hostile to his pilgrimage. Sorry. And yet he goes on. And everywhere he goes, he's confronted by Muslims saying, sometimes with posters, sometimes by putting excrement, shit, on the pathways that he's about to walk on, saying, why don't you go to Bihar, which was a North Indian state where the opposite was happening, where Hindus were slaughtering Muslims. Stop bothering us. This place is calmed down. Go and deal with your own people and accept Pakistan. That was the message they sent back to him. And he trudged on and said he would spend the rest of his life in Noakhali till peace came to India. Well, he, for one reason or another, he didn't, and he went off to Bihar. But his last months are this kind of very moving, frustrated search for a lever of personal endeavor that will turn the subcontinent around from the course that it's hurtling down. And of course, it doesn't work. This is where I think he becomes tragic. But he comes close in the end to some remarkable successes. The mass killings go on. The population transfers by the millions go on. But in Calcutta, at the time of independence, Gandhi's presence there actually a rioting just begins, and Gandhi goes on a fast, and it works. Everybody, the Muslims and Hindus, come to him together while he's fasting, and they promise there'll be peace, and there is peace. And then he says, "Okay, now I'm going back to Noakhali." But at just that point, rioting breaks out in Delhi, so he goes up to Delhi and does the same thing again. And again, there's a response to his example. Just one man, by the force of his own personality, everybody realizes what a disgrace it would be if this amazing figure, the creator of the whole movement that's gotten us to this point, messy as it is, were to die because we need to kill each other, and they stop rioting there. All of this produces a kind of resentment among Hindu chauvinists and the Hindu refugees who are pouring in from what has now become Pakistan. Who are full of bitter resentment of the Muslims who had been killing them, and want to do the same to drive Muslims out of various neighborhoods in Delhi. And Gandhi's effectiveness at the end has something to do, it's not cause and effect, but it has something to do with his assassination. The government responds to demands he makes for easing the tension with Pakistan. And at the same time, a conspiracy of crazy Hindus gets going. People feel that this will just go on. Gandhi will continue to subvert the rule of Hindu leadership in India, and he's finally assassinated. And the killer, when it comes time for his trial, actually pleads that his explanation for why he shot Gandhi is that Gandhi's lofty character made it impossible for the government to resist him. And because of Gandhi's ceaseless work, his selflessness, his lofty character, he had to be removed from the scene in order that the authority of the Hindu community could be properly established. Amazing explanation for an assassination.
How was the assassin ultimately punished?
He was hung. He was hung.
I want to turn, maybe it's from the sublime to the ridiculous, but I think the sexual things that you write about in the book have gotten a lot of controversy. So I just want to, we don't have that much time before we open it up to questions. So I just want to raise three things and let you do what you want with them. Gandhi took a vow of celibacy in about 1906, and as far as we know, he never slept with his wife again. And he did that even though Hinduism...
I think it's pretty sure he didn't sleep with his wife again.
And as you say, Hinduism doesn't particularly frown on sexuality, so... No. There's some question in that. Second of all, you talk about
it also doesn't frown on celibacy. I mean, there are a lot of mansions in Hindu thought, and the values of what's called brahmacharya that he was taking upon himself have a great tradition in themselves. For somebody who wants to lead a holy life, and what was unusual about Gandhi was he wanted to lead a holy life through politics.
So the second piece of this is you describe his relationship with Hermann Kallenbach, who's a German Jew.
This is back in South Africa.
Who he met in South Africa, but who he maintained a relationship with his whole life. You call it an intimate and ambiguous relationship. You say they lived together. They professed love. I say they professed love for one another in their letters. Gandhi wrote, you have possession of my body. They had nicknames for each other that they called. They were a couple. You quote someone saying they were a couple. And yet you conclude that the relationship was homoerotic but not homosexual.
That's somebody else's conclusion. I quote it.
Oh, okay. Okay. So I'm curious what your
conclusion
is.
I had to go to the dictionary
to find out the difference
between homoerotic and homosexual.
They didn't act on it.
Yeah. They had the attraction, but they didn't act.
So what is your conclusion?
My conclusion is, and perhaps is, I think when we think about this, we're influenced by our own times, and we really have to step back in time. I think we find it hard to believe in platonic relationships. I think maybe it was easier then. There's a lot of sexual... We only have Gandhi's letters to Kallenbach. I think they vowed to destroy one another's letters. And Kallenbach didn't live up to his promise. So, and his letters only came into public view about 20 years ago. I think I'm not the first one to have read them. They're published as a volume in that Gandhi Collected Works, but they've been in the public domain all this time. But I'm the first one to have used them extensively. There's a lot of sexual teasing in the letters. There's a lot of humor. There's a lot of, these are Gandhi's letters, a lot of expressions of love. There's a clear expression that Kallenbach will stay at his side for the rest of his life. Gandhi writes a contract to govern their relationship. Included in the contract is where they will sleep, you know, and what roles they will play. I think it's a fascinating thing all in all in itself. I deal with it by saying, I quote an Indian Gandhian scholar saying they were a couple, and I then raise the question, what kind of couple were they? And that, for about a page and a half, I play with the idea that, you know, that it would be easy to by lining up various circumstantial situations and things they said to imply that they were, that this was a homosexual relationship. I then went on to say, but perhaps we should pay close attention to what they actually said and did in that period. And I then talk about their great concentration on diet as a way of controlling sexual urges, physical urges. And I then deal with the unfolding of the relationship over the years. I thought that what I was clearly showing was that it was a loving celibate relationship, but I didn't declare that as a conclusion because who knows, whoever knows what's going on with another two people, I didn't declare that as a, and what happened was that the actual sentences in that business were in those paragraphs where I was saying it would be easy to show were detached one from the other in the context of the argument I was making, mm-hmm. and were just thrown out there. So a review in the Wall Street Journal, which was not particularly unfriendly to my book, but hugely hostile to Gandhi, described him as a sexual weirdo. This then led to a tabloid article in the London Daily Mail with the headline, Gandhi left wife for gay lover. This then led to 1,000 Indian websites going, just lighting up and going crazy about this American writer who said that Gandhi was not only a racist but gay, and this then led to the government of Gujarat banning my book, which didn't exist in India, and
to the sale of 30,000 extra copies, no doubt.
Well, I will get to that. The legislature of Maharashtra called for a ban, but never acted on it. The national law minister said they would consider a national ban, and my publisher advanced the publication date of the book by 3 months, tripled the press run, and by May it was number one on the bestseller list for English language books in India. So
a lesson to all authors.
Yeah. So I owe a lot. And the man who banned it, as some people here who follow Indian politics will know, is the most flamboyant and most feared and least Gandhian politician on the national scene, a man named Narendra Modi, who is the chief minister of Gujarat and an aspirant for national leadership of the Hindu chauvinist party. And so I always refer to that, I was in India early this year, I refer to that as Mr. Modi's fatwa, just to get on.
So we have to wrap this up. I have 1,000 more questions that I didn't get to, but let me ask you, you raised this question near the end of the book, I think, and I'd like to hear your answer, and that is, how would India or the world be different if Gandhi had remained a small-town lawyer in South Africa?
Well, I didn't attempt to answer it.
I know. That's why I was hoping you would for us.
And I was just trying to make a point about the influence of personality on history. I think what I did say there was that it was entirely imaginable that if Gandhi had not returned to India, that the Jinnah would have remained Indian nationalist, that the whole sartorial change that Gandhi brought in, not only into his own life, but into Indian politics, which makes it almost impossible for an Indian political figure to appear in a conventional Western suit, which has become the dress of most modern societies, but they have to appear in homespun garments because that's what Gandhi wore. That Nehru would have made his independent speech in a double-breasted suit if Gandhi had not returned. I can't take it any further than that. He had a huge impact on India. He still has a huge impact on India. One of the calculations that I've done, not in the book, but thinking about this, is, you know, to say that Gandhi had no influence on Indian social values would be crazy. Most well-educated Indians would espouse the ideas, if asked, of social equality and social justice that Gandhi fought so passionately for. They might not live by them, but a lot of us don't live by the values we espouse. But when you think about it, India is a country of, what, 1.2 billion people? So how many people are there whose thinking has been heavily influenced by, directly or indirectly, by the example of Gandhi? They all revere him as the father of the nation. We all revere George Washington. But they don't all think about him. If there are 4 or 5 million, that's less than 0.5% of the Indian population. If there are 25 million, that's less than 2% of the Indian population. I can't imagine that there are more than 25 million. So Gandhi's there. I mean, he's there as an example of anybody who wants to change India. As a matter of social reform and justice, is in some sense a Gandhian and is aware of his example. But but it's not predominant. There's an article in my old newspaper today about child labor in the homes of well-to-do Indians, and and it tells the story of a 13-year-old girl who was sold into bonded labor, something like the indenture laborers in South Africa, by her uncle. And the case is now all over the Indian newspapers, but when you look at it, it appears to be a very commonplace thing.
Thank you. Why don't we open it up to questions now? Great. For about 15 minutes or so. This guy over here. There's a mic coming to you.
Yeah, thank you. I'd like to pick up on the last point you raised and ask whether you believe, given your experience, the fierce reaction to your book in India, but also the controversy regarding Salman Rushdie and the Jaipur Literary Festival, which you were at.
Yeah.
Do you think that the Indian political class is doing a good job in living up to Gandhian ideals regarding political and intellectual tolerance?
No, obviously not. But those ideals do exist. The Jaipur Literature Festival is said to be the world's biggest book fair, and a couple of hundred writers are invited there and converge there and speak on panels, and it goes on for 4 days, and there are five things going at once every hour of the day. It's quite an amazing thing. And I think this year something like 70,000 people came. And those audiences were so intelligent and so well-informed and so refined in their reactions. It was heartwarming and very, very touching. I've never appeared before audiences of that size to have discussions of the sort we're having tonight. And there were 3,000-4,000 people sitting there in front of you. It was an experience. Now, at the same time, Salman Rushdie was going to make one of his visits to India, and every time he does, some group of Muslims says, no, there's a fatwa against him, and he wrote this awful book, and they demonstrate and march. I saw one of those demonstrations, 100 people marching up and down the street of Jaipur saying, Salman Rushdie Murtabad, which was death to Salman Rushdie. Didn't look very threatening, but the government of the state of Rajasthan said they had intelligence that there was a conspiracy to kill him if he came, and they demanded that the invitation be withdrawn, and the invitation was sort of withdrawn, and he didn't come. And I think he would have been perfectly safe if he came, and that the Indian authorities could easily have protected him, and it was kind of disgraceful, but that kind of thing happens in India. Just as books get banned in India. But I was grateful for the Rushdie controversy because it for sure overshadowed the Lalibela controversy, and which hardly anybody mentioned. But there had been a demonstration in Delhi last April where about 24 scruffy guys walked around with signs that said, hang Joseph Lalibela. And they carried... If you type those words, hang Joseph Lalibela, into Google, this will come up, and you'll see pictures of me with a noose around my neck. My daughter didn't like that, but I don't. There's a lot of turbulence built into India, and there are a lot of people of good values. And one doesn't cancel the other.
Sure. It has been said that Gandhi's ideas of nonviolence and tactics worked in India because the British were of a certain character. Whereas Gandhi's ideas and tactics, say he had been in Germany under Hitler or in Russia under Stalin, wouldn't have worked. What is your idea on that?
Well, Hitler once said to a British cabinet minister, I don't know who it was, but it was in the pre-Munich period, it's easy to deal with Gandhi, shoot him. So obviously there's some considerable truth to that. But whether inspired directly by Gandhi or not, Gandhi's values have worked in other places. I think you can say, whatever we think about the ultimate result, it worked in Egypt. I think you can say it worked in Tunisia. It worked in the Philippines at the time of the downfall of Ferdinand Marcos. It hasn't been a huge success in Syria or Libya. It's problematic. It takes leadership. It takes discipline. It is by no means automatic. But Gandhi's idea of nonviolent struggle allowed for the possibility that people would die. And part of his advice to Czechs and Jews threatened by the Nazis was that you had to, I don't think this was good advice, but you have to face their guns fearlessly. Meaning that if they shoot enough people, the society will react, the world will react, and things will come right. But you, the individual, satyagrahi, as he would have said it, you, the individual, nonviolence isn't just nonviolence, it's nonviolent struggle and discipline. You have to be prepared to die for this to work. And there have been some stunning examples in our own country. If you think of the Selma March, which I think is one of the great examples of disciplined, nonviolent struggle. Gandhi's own Salt March is perhaps the greatest example. But I think the most interesting part of the point you made about the British is that Gandhi affected not so much the British authorities, but the British public. All of this was fully reported in England, and Orwell has a fascinating essay in which he said, Orwell was no devoted Gandhian by any means, but he said his greatest success was in converting the British public, because he did all this without rancor, without hatred, without vituperation, and the British saw the justice of his argument and his appeal even before well before their government did.
Can you tell us if there are any specific events that influenced his character while he was studying at Oxford? And can you also let us know what was the longest fast that he ever conducted?
It wasn't Oxford. It was the Inner Temple, the Inns of Court in London. And the events that influenced him there probably had more to do with his interaction with vegetarians and theosophists than anything else. He was also influenced on one of his trips to Britain as a leader of the South African Indian community. He became aware of the nonviolent demonstrations of the earliest suffragettes, and that had some influence on his thinking of what was possible. I think I'm missing a second point.
Longest fast.
Longest fast. I'm not sure that he ever went longer than 2 weeks. Usually his fasts had his earliest fasts were not meant to have a broad national impact. And it's only in the 30s that he first fasts to have an impact on major political events. And I think that fast went something like 13 days. Of course, at the end of his life, when he was fasting, he had those two major fasts in 1947 and 8, I mean, in the last half year of his life. At that point, he was 77 and then 78 years old. And he was a man who had suffered from hypertension for years. He was in pretty good shape in that he walked a lot, and as he showed in Noah Kali, you know, he was capable of hiking 10, 12 miles a day in tough circumstances. But he was clearly putting his life at risk in those last fasts, and one of the reasons they had the impact they had, this was visible to the people who saw him.
All right, peace be with you. Your reflections on Gandhi as husband? Madam Gandhiji? Was she as satisfied as in the movie as in reality, now that we know more about his
Love life? I've never... They didn't have much of a home life after Gandhi moved up to Johannesburg. She was sometimes in his environment, but he was out campaigning a lot of the time. She wasn't inevitably at his side. She was no Anne Rooney, you know, standing up there speaking. She was, I think she remained basically illiterate for the rest of her life. She was very loyal. She came along with him. She had embraced his values.
She went to jail, didn't she?
She went to jail. She died in jail.
Is that right?
And in Gandhi's arms in Yerevada, in the Aga Khan prison in Palace, which where Gandhi was under house arrest in 1943. But and she's there was some tenderness between them, but there are numerous times when he complains that she's driving him crazy, usually on some issue to do with untouchability. There are some books that I've seen and haven't deeply gone into that memorialize her as the mother of the nation and a great woman. And maybe she was, and I don't give her enough credit for that, but to my mind, from the little I've come upon in my reading, she was a good Hindu wife who in the most traditional sense, and not a force in Gandhi's life at all in the later years.
Okay.
Before I hand over the mic, I just wanted to announce the winner from the raffle tonight. Dilu Ashby, if you're here, you've won 2 tickets, and you can talk to me after the program.
With Gandhi.
You've won a 3-week trip to India.
Yeah.
Was Gandhi religious, and what you explained what led to his epiphany, so to speak, about the caste system because of what he saw in South Africa, but what led to his views about what the relationship should be between Hindus and Muslims?
Well, his first employers were Muslims in South Africa. His first political speeches were delivered in mosques. Gandhi was very comfortable with Muslims, partly because of the part of Gujarat he came from, but partly and the traditions of that specific area, but partly because of his South African experiences. Was he religious? Gandhi was definitely religious in a very serious way, but a idiosyncratic way too. He was very eclectic and wide-ranging in his religious values, and essentially thought that all religions were true in a different idiom. And he did not go to, although he campaigned earnestly for the opening of Hindu temples to untouchables, he himself didn't worship in temples. And his prayers were, for the most part, solitary, and his prayer meetings were really involved the him giving a kind of sermonette and the singing of various hymns from various religious traditions. He was extremely ecumenical in his religious values, but in his own way he was religious. Often when Gandhi gets into disputes with orthodox Hindus, and of course you have to understand that Hinduism is in itself shorthand. The concept of one Indian religious tradition is something that's been imposed on it by outsiders. There are, under the term Hinduism, there are a number of religious traditions, but Gandhi, I think as time went on, learned more and more about the traditional Indian values, but when he used Indian religious concepts in his arguments with orthodox Christians, he always said, according to my definition, and then he would define something that had a rather well-settled definition in Indian life and practice, and his definition would be some other idea that made it more contemporary, more open-minded, less exclusionist, and that inserted some egalitarian values. So I can see why orthodox Hindus thought he wasn't genuinely religious, but in his own terms he certainly was, and is accepted as such. And the Indian religious tradition is very generous in its ability to absorb all kinds of influences.
Hi, thank you very much, by the way. Very interesting book. Is Gandhi considered, his teachings at all influenced in the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa? And does South Africa consider him at all a favorite son?
I'll do the second part first. Okay. Very much so, because it's important to South Africa's current self-image that it's a rainbow nation, that all the people are part of the nation. And Gandhi is the great Indian figure that the Indian community produced in South Africa. So the history has been tidied up, and he has been he's advanced as a founding father of the state that has come into being after apartheid. What was the first part of the question? I'm having trouble.
Well, did he actually influence the movement?
He did for about half a year and a half. Long after he was there, in the early 1950s, what became the National Indian Congress in South Africa allied itself with the African National Congress in what was called the Defiance Campaign, and they attempted nonviolent resistance, and this was shut down pretty rapidly by the apartheid state, and Mandela writes about this in his memoir. Mandela was very utilitarian in his sense of what nonviolence was all about. If it works, great. If not, we'll have to move on to something else. Well, it didn't work, so they moved on to a low-grade violent struggle that went on for the next 40 years with decidedly mixed results, but in some sense contributed to the wind-up of apartheid.
Thank you all very much for coming. I want to...
Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. The Allowed theme was composed by Larry Karish.